Chapter 8. Balthazar gestured to the fishmonger that he should move the bass on the top of his cart to allow him to see the ones beneath. The fish below had pinker gills and clearer eyes. More hurriedly than his wont, the councillor chose one and gave the delivery boy his West Park address. He waited to pay for his selection until he saw the boy wrap it up and set out on his way. Having spent the first 4 decades of his life in a landlocked estate, fresh fish still exerted a strong appeal. He'd left the carriage a block from Quayside, partly so he could stroll the dock area without being observed by palace coachmen. Balthazar stared unseeing at the lively wharf, swarming with ships, bustling with men, and crammed with goods. The Weir capital was located here to take advantage of trade. Cascada boasted the most extensive seaport in the realm, though Queen's Harbour in the south came in a close second. Because the Nargis River emptied into this basin, the water in the cove sparkled with crystal clarity, and the Weirs strove to keep it that way. Foreign sailors soon learned that tossing refuse or filth into any water source was an unpardonable offence in a country whose motto was the waters of life. Balthazar could see down to the sandy bottom of the bay, teeming with minnows, and spot a few seashells. Today, however, his thoughts strayed far from water quality.
Katrina, what would you have made of the Oro letter, the assassination attempt, and Thumb's behaviour?
Unbidden, rather than the myriad of formal occasions on which he had conferred with the late queen, he recalled the sight of her face on the pillow next to him, framed by a cloud of dishevelled blue. When she was thinking hard, a dimpled indent formed between her straight brows. Once he had dared to reach over to touch it with his forefinger. He could never figure out why Queen Katrina had invited him into her bed that summer night. He knew that he had cut a handsome figure some 15 years ago, but lust could not have been the motivation. The queen appeared to enjoy their conversation afterward more than the sex. Cressa was away that summer visiting her father. The marriage had died some years earlier. Balthazar often wondered if Katrina had been lonely. Balthazar woke from his reverie to walk down the quay to the harbour master's hut. The figureheads, paintings and flags of the assorted ships at dock today stared back at him with pride or challenge. With the winds of a near mon so unpredictable and challenging, all had both oars and sails in varied configurations depending upon their function. Ocean-going traders had deeper keels for cargo and long multi-person oars to get them out of harbour or row them to more favourable breezes, while passenger ships had shallower hulls and more comfortable below-deck designs. Naval galleys, either escorts or war vessels, warned away attackers with their hull-shattering rams and bristles of oars, which made them capable of high speeds and adept manoeuvres. Dodging dockers pushing carts laden with dry goods and livestock, Balthazar noticed Queen Cara, the Royal War Galley, named after Weirendale's first queen, at anchor in the bay, her 3 masts of lateen sails furled, her gilding flashing in the sun.
"I have a query for Seamaster Bashkin," he told the officer on duty in the harbour master's hut. "'Tis merely a trifle, but do you know where he is to be found?"
"He's in port. He leases a little house on the north side of the harbour, sir. Would you like me to send a runner to fetch him?"
"Is that so?"
Balthazar meditatively rubbed the bridge of his nose.
"It really is not that important. But if you could send a lad to say that
I'm going to have a drop of ale at first call, and if it doesn't inconvenience him, I'd be pleased to meet him there. I would take this as a kindness.
Just so, sir.
What name should the runner give the Seamaster?
Name?
Aye, sir, so Bashkim knows who wants him. See?
Oh, of course. Tell him, Lord Bass.
He could have kicked himself for this foolish name. He should have had a better answer at the ready. He strolled out of the hut, walked a ways, and then leaned against a crude wooden wagon to pull the wrinkles out of his hose. When he glanced up, he spied one of his own coachmen clumsily ducking behind a dockworker carrying a bale on his head. The man had followed him, spying. Balcazar deliberately straightened the other hose while he thought through how to handle the situation. Balcazar decided to broach the coachman directly. He walked straight up to the abashed servant.
Left the coach unattended, have you?
Ah! Oh! No,
sir. My mate still holds the horses.
Good. Why aren't you with him?
The poor man squinched up his cheeks and stuttered for long seconds. Beg pardon.
Is he... Sir...
The man's tongue-tied stutter gave Balcazar time to pretend he didn't know the servant was working for Matwick.
I see. Well, there's no shame in needing to find the Jakes. Now return to the coach. I am stopping at first call, but I won't be long. And I'll not want to wait on you.
Balcazar quickened his pace, pleased that he had handled this situation adroitly. He thought that Cressa's plan of placing herself out of reach until the palace danger settled showed prudence, not what Katrina would have done, but the daughter had not the mother's strength. The mother had had a strong nose and a firm jaw. Cressa's features were more delicate. But the daughter was showing surprising craftiness in this present emergency.
Poor thing. Her elevation came so unexpectedly. I told Angelica her sobriquet should be Cressa the Reluctant or Cressa the Unready.
Balcazar felt certain that Tenny and Jurgen would side with him against Matwick and Treasurer Prision, and he was certain he could count on Lord Retzel and Duchess Latley too, now that the game had turned so serious. Despite their constant cavilling, surely they knew their duty. Together they would uncover Matwick's plot and force him to resign, and then send a message to Sea Sprite that the Queen could safely return.
One bowl of chowder, one pitcher of ale, and two tankards,
he called to the proprietor as he entered the tavern, so gloomy after the glare of the sun on the water. He slid onto a beaten-up wooden bench facing the door. As far as Balcazar could tell, none of the people inside paid any attention to him. He didn't recognise any as Matwick's men.
Queen Cressa will be pleased with my service to the waters. She might be grateful enough to see that my sons receive some slight preferment. I would so like to see my children well set up.
The rushed barmaid plunked the pitcher down so hard it sloshed. Balcazar poured a tankard but stared at the bubbles, worrying over the strange concatenation of alarming events. Then his mind circled back, as it did too often for a married father in his fifth decade, to that one summer night.
Why could I not stir you to pleasure? Angelique always seems satisfied.
A server set the chowder in front of him, breaking his reverie. A group of sailors at the bar jostled one another with rowdy high spirits.
"I have a most powerful thirst," crowed one of the sailors. "We've been out forever. Keep 'em coming as fast as you can pour 'em. For moons I've dreamed of nothing but ale."
"Men want what they cannot have," Balcazar realised, and this old truism struck him with renewed force.
"I cannot have Katrina. Even when she lay within my arms, she withheld herself." "What is it that Matwick wants that he cannot have? What do the Oros want that they cannot have?"
A voice intruded on his study of the oily film on top of the chowder, which made the soup unappetizing.
"Lord Bass,"
said Seamaster Bashkim at his elbow.